is Yetta Chaikin interviewing Dr. Golden for the Jewish Historical Society on February 7th, 1991. What is your full name?
Abraham Albert Golden, G-O-L-D-E-N.
And you go as Dr. A.A. Golden. Right. When were you born?
26th of April, 1913.
Where?
In Brooklyn, New York. In our home, off Bushwick Avenue.
And tell me something about your parents.
My father, Isidore, came here when he was really young, a child, with his father from Kiev, Russia. My mother, very interestingly, came alone with her only sister from Bucharest, Romania. My mother came alone to meet an uncle in New York City for a visit, and subsequently they stayed. My father and his father and three brothers all came together from Russia, settled in Brooklyn, New York, after they were processed in Ellis Island. My grandfather was a tinsmith and worked as a tinsmith, had no trouble getting a job. Had to learn English, of course, but in those days, learning English is very simple. You went to night school. That's where they all learned English. My father became a naturalized citizen, so did all the others. Mother also became a naturalized citizen, and what English she picked up was also from night school.
Did they have any education outside of that?
Prior to coming to the United States, my mother and my aunt, who came together, her sister, as far as I can recall, had no school education.
At all?
Nothing. All they could do, they could speak Romanian, but they could not write.
Mm-hmm.
They could read a little bit, as I recall, period.
But they learned to write English.
Oh, you hear, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Everybody went to night school.
Right. And you were born in Brooklyn, New York. When did you come to Wilmington, and why did your family come?
World War I was going on, and my father decided to come to Wilmington because he also learned the tinsmithing trade, the sheet metal worker trade, allied professions, and since they were building ships in Wilmington, Delaware, at Pusey and Jones Shipyard, he felt he would go. So along he went with his wife, my mother, and three children, myself and my two sisters. And he got a job at Pusey and Jones Shipyard, where he worked throughout the episodes in World War I. Stayed there for about a couple of years after the war ended, and also learned the plumbing trade at the same time.
Did he learn it while he was shipbuilding, or was he an apprentice plumber?
He was an apprentice there, along with his regular work. He learned plumbing. He felt it was a good profession to have,
mm-hmm.
a good business, whatever you want to call it.
Did he find any discrimination?
In my recollection, no, but nobody ever called him a damn Jew, I'll tell you that. He was a short man, 5'5", with very strong arms and a knack of hitting first in case somebody insulted him. And as I recall, he didn't have a violent temper, but he was easily aroused at any discriminatory remark about his background.
Mm-hmm.
I can recall that.
Uh-huh. And so your family came here, and as a result, you stayed and raised your children here.
Mm-hmm.
Right. What can you remember? Where did you live in Wilmington when your family came? And what can you remember about life there?
We settled at a non-existing street now, I think, 623 West 2nd Street. Marble steps. And I remember my mother, LaShawn, scrubbing with a scrubbing brush every day the steps on the outside to keep them clean. They weren't steps, it was a stoop. And I can recall as a youngster drinking cocoa and milk on the step before going to school. In the house, we spoke Yiddish exclusively. I learned some odd Russian terms and Romanian terms, but not much to carry on a full-time conversation. The same applied to my sister Rose and my sister Molly. My sister Molly was not born in New York. And just recall, she was born on Parrish Street, around the corner from 623 West 2nd Street.
So she was born in Wilmington.
Molly was born in Wilmington. Born in the house. I was born at home too, so was my sister. Molly was also delivered at home, no hospital deal. Next door to me was a German by the name of Heitz, who raised a son who became a civil engineer. Mr. Roy Heitz, was a harness maker, and his trademark was, next door to us, a house he had a facsimile of a harness.
What, as a sign? As a sign? Or
as a sign.
Uh-huh.
Next door to Mr. Heitz was the original bakery of Del Campo's Bakery. And I went to school with all the Del Campo children. The school was on Jefferson Street between 2nd and 3rd, and was called Number 3 School. When I started school, I didn't know a word of English.
Did you have any Jewish neighbors at all?
Yes. I'll come to that.
Mm-hmm.
Up the street was the barbershop of Ben Caney and his brother, Lashawn. Well, Ben Caney's gone too. Manuel. Manny and Ben were barbers up the street on the corner of Parrish Street and West 2nd Street. Manny later on left his brother to barber alone and opened up a clothing shop on Market Street, Caney's Barbershop. Up the street from us was, on a corner, was Mr. Weintraub. And what did Mr. Weintraub have? A grocery store.
Is that the same Weintraub that had the fish?
No, wait a minute. Just a moment, excuse me, I'm trying to think. Let me backtrack. Isn't it funny memory? A grocery store was on the corner of 2nd and Jefferson Street. Yeah, Weintraub. Next door, below Mr. Weintraub, was the furniture store of the late Harry Kaufman. He had a furniture store there. And then moved away, but his furniture store was there for a long time. Across the street was an Italian couple who had a shoe repair place, Del Campo, who had children who became a couple of lawyers and engineers. Strange to say, across the street, directly across the street from where we lived, were four black families whose names I never did know. And they drove Pierce Arrows, the two men. Why did they drive Pierce Arrows? They were chauffeurs for somebody in the DuPont family, and they were given the privilege of driving
the car
back and forth in the car, to work and to home. The oddest thing that I can recall also, either in grammar school or in my first year in high school, I asked the question, where did the black kids go to school? It never occurred to me that there was then a distinction. All I know is, there were no black kids in school with me, but I never gave it a thought, and I don't think a lot of white people
No,
did.
That's very true.
I never thought about it till I was in high school. And then I found they had their own separate schools. That gave me the idea of, well, who are they? I didn't know a thing about black people, except the color was different. We were raised without any discrimination at all. As far as I know, people were people.
In your neighborhood?
In my neighborhood, Longport. Yeah. We had Italians living around there, the Campo family I mentioned. Around the corner were three Spanish people, one of whom went to school with me. Their name was Larca, L-L-O-R-C-A. He died about a year ago, a schoolmate of mine. And I still carry a scar from a fight we had because he called me a Christ killer. And I never knew what a Christ killer was. I never heard the term, but I felt it was a bad thing. We had a fight and he pulled a little penknife on me. And here is a scar on my right hand as we were fighting on the ground. But that went over. That was a something.
Where did you go to school?
Wilmington High School.
Yeah.
From 623 West 2nd Street, after things improved, this, that, and the other, Pop opened up a plumbing shop on his own at 311 Shipley Street.
Were there other Jewish plumbers?
He was the only Jewish master plumber in the state of Delaware.
He was the first and only?
The first and only. And he was held in high esteem.
Because he was...
by the Master Plumbers Association.
And how about by the Jewish community?
Oh, also. We were active, he was active in the Casa Shalemis on Shipley Street, which incidentally started as a Sephardish synagogue.
In what year, do you know?
1914.
It started.
I'll give you the year.
So your father, was your father a charter member?
He was one of the members.
He's an early member, as my father was.
The Chaikin family was concerned. The tall, tall Chaikin who worked in the Jewish Legion.
Yeah.
In World War I, in Israel, in Palestine, as a part of the British Corps, I think. Tall, husky man, I remember him. I forget his first name now, but Chaikin,
he was a cleaner.
Opened up a cleaning store at the corner of 4th and Orange Street. What else can I say? Several things.
How about you? Did you have religious training? Did you go to?
I had the late Harry Bloom come to the house to teach me to read Yiddish, which I knew anyhow, but Yiddish. The books I had were by Jewish then authors like Peretz, Shalom Ash.
Were your sisters educated also?
Not to the degree that I was. Mm-hmm. They knew how to daven, but I was the guy who went to cheder down at the shul, besides having special home lessons. I was bar mitzvah, in Wilmington. My folks, I was bar mitzvah at the Chesed Shalem Synagogue. There was a Rabbi Sabritsky then, who was also a shochet, who had his place of business.
Was this before Rabbi First?
This is before Rabbi First. Rabbi First came after Sabritsky. Mm-hmm. But I was in the choir at Chesed Shalem, and Sabritsky was the chazan. After we moved to 311 Shipley Street, where Pop opened up his own personal shop for plumbing and heating and passed his board, so to speak, to be a licensed plumber. The Berger family lived down the street from me with the 12 or 13 kids. When I first went to visit the Bergers, Simon went to school with me all the way through to high school. The third floor was where they slept, and I thought I was an army barrack because there were bunks all over the third floor where all the kids slept.
Simon is the one that became the doctor.
Simon became a doctor, a radiologist, and now the only time I see him, God forbid, is when you have tzaddis, when one of his brothers died.
Yeah. But, so, the Bergers lived on that block.
Bergers,
who else?
The third and Shipley Street.
Uh-huh.
My mother, we lived above where the Chesed Shalem Synagogue was. So.
Oh, you lived above?
Oh, yeah, 311. Uh-huh. The shul was at 223. Don't ask me how I remember the number. Uh-huh. The shul of Chesed Shalem was 223 Shipley.
And there was a schwitz.
A schwitz by cats.
Yeah, it was a Turkish bath.
Every Saturday night, Popeye and my uncle, Jaime Schinfeld, we go Saturday night in schwitz. And most of the times, even though I lived up the street, we stayed there the night.
Was that a common practice?
Oh, yeah. Eating pastrami sandwiches and corned beef sandwiches that we got from Rip's Delicatessen store on West Sector Street.
Around the block.
Yes.
Yes.
Eventually, I don't know when, I said we lived near next door to Del Campo's Bakery on West Sector Street.
Right.
Next door to us directly was Karp's Bakery at the corner of 2nd and Parish. Mrs. Karp, the late Mrs. Karp, may she rest in peace, was so enamored of my sister Molly that she offered my mother a terrific sum of money to adopt her. Well, naturally, you know what the response of a Jewish mother would be. No way.
Yeah.
But she loved my daughter, my sister Molly.
Yeah. Now, you had two sisters.
Yeah,
and whom did they marry?
Rose married Leon Horowitz. Molly married Benjamin D. Cohen, whose parents had a grocery store at the corner of 12th and Walnut Streets. My sister Rose died a year ago. Her husband Leon died 8 months prior to that. Thank God my sister Molly is still alive and active, and so is her husband, Ben Cohen. I married an out-of-town Jewish girl who had relatives here, known by the name of Rafelson. The Rafelson family, Lou Rafelson, who had a scrapyard, was her uncle. Her father and Lou Rafelson were brothers.
And how did you meet?
It's an interesting story. I was in the Navy in World War II. My mother had died in 1941 of a disease that today she would not have died from. No antibiotics, no dialysis, and a strep throat, and died of acute renal failure. Mm. I was so unbelieving that this could have happened to my mother so fast, in 8 days, that I gave permission for an autopsy, which was contrary to my Jewish thinking, but I wanted to know, and so did the family doctor, the late Dr. Jacob Kaiser. And it showed these small kidneys. It proved the diagnosis. Anyhow, I went to the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. I belonged to a neighbor.
What motivated you to go into medicine?
MDs won't like this, but my father had a stomach condition of some sort. And he went to doctor after doctor here in Bloomington and in Philadelphia. He went to the best. He went to Bacchus, he went to Eberhardt, who was known as the guy for stomach disease. Nobody helped him. He went to an osteopathic doctor here in Wilmington, who's dead now, the late Dr. Theodore Stigler, and he went just for manipulation because the doctor felt this is what he needed. The medicine was of no value to him. And after I graduated high school and was deciding what to do, my classmates were all going to Jeff, to college first, and then to Jeff. He said to me, you be a doctor like Dr. Stigler. So I went for 1 year to college. In those days, you didn't need 4 years to go to an osteopathic college. Now you do, but in those days, all you needed was 1 year of college physics, chemistry, and biology.
Would you have had any trouble getting into a medical school?
No, I wouldn't have had any trouble. I was a good student.
But because there was discrimination, and there were quotas.
Yes, but I didn't worry. If my cousin Lou Shinfield got in, who's retired now from obstetric and gynecology, if my best friend Simon Berger got in, and Jake Bailey got the Jeff afterwards, I'm just as good. I would have gotten in. Because even then they were starting to give a little extra credit to Delaware students. This was at Jefferson.
Uh-huh.
I never applied. I just went straight to the osteopathic college. First I had regrets because in those days osteopathic doctors were not considered physicians. It's all changed now. So, but I never had regrets. I just checked. I go through life and make it, which I did.
Yes. Did you feel you got a good education?
I think I got a very good education. Let's go back to Second Street, shall we?
Okay, let's go back.
Hop was a well-known bicyclist in Brooklyn, New York. He belonged to what was known as the Century Road Club of America, of which my son and I had mementos of his, what he had, especially my son, who's a teacher in New York City, a school teacher in the Board of Education. And many and many a ride I remember with Pop's racing bike sitting on the handlebars as we went down Second Street to shop. We shopped at Fishman's Bakery when it was there. And then, of course, Blackman came there. The grocer Malinsky was there. Across the street was Rip's Delicatessen store. Pop would ride me on the bicycle and I was scared stiff. We had no brake, it was a racing bike. He put his foot on the front tire to slow up, and there was a hill called on Second Street from West Street down to Tackle Street.
That's rather steep.
Oh, and boy,
How was he able to bicycle up that hill?
He just pumped away. Pop was a very strong man. He lived to survive a stroke for 7 years, and I had him in the Kutz home.
How old was he when he died?
He died at age 89. His father, Harry, that he came to this country with, died at age 91.
Sounds to me like you have good genes.
Yes, I hope so. I'm not going to tell you how old. You know how old I am. And I'm active. I don't intend to rust out. So anyhow, that's Second Street. I remember the bicycle. I remember Brody's and Smedley's lumber yard on the corner of Second and Madison. I remember the Ostro family, who had a linen shop on the corner also of 2nd and Madison Street.
They had, where was their store?
The daughter was Hillerson, the family Hillerson. She was a school teacher, a violin teacher. The old doctor.
She became Helen Frankel.
Frankel, yeah, that's it. So they were down the street from us. We didn't know them too well, but they were down the street. I'm trying to think of another Jewish family. I don't think so.
But you were well acquainted with the families on the stores on Second Street.
Oh yeah,
there.
Sure.
You did all your shopping there.
All of our shopping there. That was our life.
Was that the place to meet? Was that the place, a social?
The kibbutz on Sunday.
Yeah.
Especially when you'd buy.
How about Saturday night?
Saturday night, sometime on the corner of Second and Orange Street. It was owned by a Jewish fella whose name I don't recall, but I remember I learned to play poker there. As I got older, with I think the man's name was Friedman, I forget. He was related to the Lubin family sister in Bloomington.
So what you're saying is that it was
it was a mecca.
It was a wonderful growing up period.
I had a happy childhood. As I say, relatively no except that one episode.
Yeah.
And I didn't allow it to go any further. Oh, Harry Bloom, my Hebrew teacher, his son, Saul, was a student with me. I don't know what happened to Saul Bloom.
Was that from Bloom's...
Bloom has the coffee deal, you know?
Did he have a store on Second Street? Bloom's Delicatessen?
I forgot. Thanks for reminding me. Bloom, A. Bloom, B-L-O-O-M, had a grocery store. That's where we got the forwards. That's where we got the Jewish papers, the Tug and the forwards. And I still read Yiddish. That was another grocery store, Bloom. The girls went to school with me. I can't think of the name whatsoever. But a younger son's name was Mike Bloom.
Mike.
Who I think used to do work with iron and pipes.
Yeah.
Or construction.
I think he's still around town.
Is he still around?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there was a daughter named... I don't know, Ruth or Anna, I'm not sure. Anna, I think, was the name. I reviewed all this last night mentally.
All right. So you're saying, really, that it was a very homogeneous community, and everybody got along well.
It was family life. Now, of course, we were ordinary Jewish people. We knew that there were other Jews living elsewhere in Wilmington, but they were the rich Jewish people whom we did not know then.
Mm-hmm. They didn't come down to Second Street.
Not that I can recall. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever go to the YMYWHA?
Oh, sure, 13.
Right.
That's where my folks had my bar mitzvah party.
Uh-huh.
And I gave my bar mitzvah speech to my...
But you didn't do it in Chesed Shlemeth.
No, I was bar mitzvah Chesed Shlemeth. Yeah. Which was, by the way, I said it was originally a Sephardish shul. Once you go in there, you know it was because the bima was in the middle of the congregation. And the women sat on top. When I married my wife in 1943, we were married in Norristown. Rabbi First was dead then. She went with me to shul twice and said, Abe, I'm not coming here again with you. If I can't sit with you like I did with my mother and father in Norristown, I'm not coming here. We'll join Beth Shalom. Which I followed the rules of my wife and we joined Beth Shalom. But I never gave up my membership. Even today, I belong to the Adas Kodesh Shalema Synagogue on Torah Drive, half a block from where I live now, and I'm also a dues-paying member at Beth Shalom. I just felt a sense of allegiance. You asked me before how I met my wife. I was in the Navy. Mr. Lou Rapeson asked me to go to a wedding of a cousin of his. I mean, a niece of his. I was stationed in the Naval Hospital in Philadelphia. My rank was Chief Petty Officer. I could not get a commission like they do today because I was an osteopathic doctor. But they called me in, and since I was a physician, even though they didn't recognize my physician rank, I worked on the shipways where I got my first taste of doing anesthesia and helped to do an electrocardiogram laboratory. And the Naval Hospital in Philadelphia was a big, big place. They had or expected so many casualties that besides the hospital, they built extra barracks on the outside. That was way down deep in South Philadelphia, across the street from a park they call League Island Park or something like that. It passed 17th and Passyunk Avenue, I think, was the address. So I said, I don't want to go to the wedding. My mother's only been dead 4 months. Don't have to dance. You go in, maybe you'll meet some people, and that's that. I said, okay. So I went. This was in 1941. And as I walked in, the wedding was taking place at the Broadwood Hotel. I hope I'm not insulting anybody or giving any family secrets. No. It was at the Broadwood Hotel. So I walked in. To anybody who's familiar with the Broadwood, you walked up three little steps, turned to the right, and then you were in the main ballroom. And I saw a stage. And in front of the stage, I saw three women. One young woman and two older women. And I looked at the younger woman and I said automatically, mentally, there's a lady I'd like to marry. I walked over to them. I introduced myself and told them that I was from Wilmington, Delaware, Dr. Abe Golden, and I take care of the injuries that Lou Rapelson Scrapyard had. And I was asked to come here to this wedding by Mr. Louis Rapelson. One of the women introduced herself as Mrs. Helen Rapelson, the wife of Louis Rapelson's brother, Charles. The other woman was a Beth, I forget the last name, Aunt Beth. She was from Atlantic City, and of course, the daughter, Sissy. So I made a couple of remarks, then I went around, looked around all the tables to see where I would sit. Then I looked around at all the tables, see where is Sissy Rapelson sitting. And I changed her little place setting,
so I would sit at the same table.
That was that. Now let's go back a little bit, if you don't mind.
Okay.
After I got through with osteopathic hospital in college, I felt I needed, and I was in practice for 1 year, as a single man.
You didn't have to do a resident internship.
In those days, you couldn't get it for an osteopathic. They were all taken. There were only 8 hospitals in the country then. Now there are loads. So I felt I needed more attention. So, and I liked obstetrics, so I sent off a letter to the Rotunda Hospital in Dublin, Ireland. And they didn't ask any questions. I wanted to apply there, because I knew a doctor who's dead now, forget his name, Bowen, the late Dr. Bowen. I knew he had been there. He had, was born in Canada. So I wrote a letter, and lo and behold, I got back an application blank to enclose the equivalent of 5 guineas as a registration fee. In those days, the guinea was worth $5.25. I might say that the pound was worse than the English pound. This Rotunda Hospital was in Dublin, Ireland. The English pound, or Irish pound also, they were the same, was worth $4.78, as I remember. $4, almost fine. I got accepted. And so I packed my steamer truck, I went all alone.
Now this was prior to your...
Prior to my marriage.
Marriage, So you and went to
Dublin.
So you can get some more experience.
More experience.
But was this hospital a good hospital to train
in? At that time, it was, it was founded in 1745. It was the largest lying-in hospital or maternity hospital in the British Empire. It was a British Empire then.
Right.
And there I met fellas from India, because Great Britain supplied doctors in what they was called the Indian Medical Service. And doctors would work like they do today in the Indian service here, those who get their education for free, paid by Uncle Sam. So there was the Indian Medical Service. I met Englishmen from India, Indians from India, both Muslims and Hindus. As an addition to my talk, in the hospital we have 3 separate messes or dining tables. One for those who ate anything, that was English, American, whatnot. Those who are Muslims who only follow the dietary rule, and those who were Hindus, who were primarily vegetarians. The Hindu did not believe, they didn't eat cow meat or lamb. You killed an animal.
So did you eat with the Muslims?
I ate with the Muslims.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. They knew I was Jewish.
So you didn't eat pork?
No, right. No pork. In fact, I learned when the 3 Muslims from Egypt who, they're doctors, who learned that I was going over to Paris when I was finished, they taught me conversational French in 4 months that I can still carry on today. No grammar. Because I went to Paris afterwards.
So it was a great experience.
It was a great experience. Hitler, I was in Dublin, Ireland, Hitler marched into Poland. All of them, the ambassador says, all Americans get back to home as fast as you can. By that time, I was on my way to Paris because I had an aunt and an uncle who came from Romania years before and were living there. I had their address while I was in Paris. I went there. And my aunt, when I knocked on the door, they were in near the Montmartre section of Paris. She wouldn't open the door, so I knocked again, and she opened the door slightly, and there was like a tramp lock there. I saw a picture of my uncle. I says, Tante, in Yiddish, just rebought to the nephew, Golden, America, from America, said my uncle, Laba, there.
There.
And then she let me in. And her son had met me at the railroad station. We had a good time for a week. I stayed 2 weeks there before I had to leave because of the impending war.
What happened when the Germans marched
in? When the Germans marched in, I went back again to Paris after the war with my wife. My aunt was alive and well. She died subsequently of hyperthyroidism and heart disease. I could see the diagnosis on her face. My two cousins were taken prisoner but survived. They survived World War II.
They went to
one
the death
was in
camps.
The resistance. One was no. One was in the resistance. That's Jean, the older one. Where Al was, that's the younger one, I don't know. I still treasure the bar mitzvah presents that they sent me when I became bar mitzvah. I'm backtracking. So where are we now, sweetheart?
Well, now you've just finished your. You went to Dublin.
Oh, okay.
And you're on your way back to the United States.
I did home. Since we did a lot of home deliveries in Dublin, there was a total of 7,000 deliveries a year there. That's why various Englishmen came from all over the world
to review
obstetrics. And in England at that time, to qualify as a doctor, the students had to have 23 deliveries. So, having 22 labor beds, all separated by curtains, with no anesthesia, you heard mother shying gaval, you had natural childbirth. In 1 week, all of them could complete their 23 deliveries. And I met Scottish people, English, the whole works.
When you came back to the United States?
When I came back, I did home deliveries.
Oh.
I drew plans of what the hospital used when the students went out on home deliveries. And Pop, being a plumber and a tinsmith and a master of everything, he made a duplicate. And since you had to have sterility, we had no osteopathic hospital then, I went over to the old homeopathic hospital.
On Broome Street?
It was below Lovering Avenue.
It was the Memorial Hospital.
It was then the homeopathic hospital.
Yeah, right.
They were very friendly to me because other doctors who were allopaths didn't like them. They couldn't get on the staff at
What's
the old
What's an allopath?
Freidmeier, what do I know? They're the ones who felt that the homeopathic doctors were not real doctors, and they trained at Hahnemann Hospital in Philadelphia.
The homeopathic?
Homeopathic. That changed after a while. But all through Wilmington and the Eastern Shore of Maryland, all you found were homeopathic doctors who had graduated from Hahnemann.
Hmm.
The only other homeopathic college was what was then known as the Fifth Avenue Hospital, somewhere in New York City, which is also now gone. Hahnemann, very seldom, I don't think they teach homeopathic medicine at all. Mm-hmm. They were the doctors who were called pill doctors. They carried back bags with little pills, and they tried to give pills to produce the symptoms that the patient presented. Anyhow, they felt very friendly to me and I to them. So their operator used to autoclave and sterilize my equipment. And
they sterilized your equipment, but they didn't let you use their facility.
No. I did home deliveries. I was not an MD. Their bylaws stated that. Incidentally, St. Francis just recently changed their bylaws for DOs officially, so did the Delaware Medical Center. So now you find DOs.
It's taken a long time.
Taken a long time. But I never regretted what I was doing.
Did you find there was, did you feel discrimination because you were an osteopath?
Only from lay people. Jewish people didn't come to me. In my older age, they began coming to me. I have a slew of older Jewish people now.
But
I had Jewish people then, too, who came to me only for backache. And incidentally, I'm not going to mention their names, three Jewish families who sent their fathers to me because of a backache, and I would x-ray their spines before I treated them, all had malignancy. And I told the family, they'd been going to other doctors. So that was a little feather in my cap. And one of the families I still see.
Oh, really?
Yes. So that was that. But that's, I say that would be a minor thing. I was happy. I thank God I was alive. Incidentally, while I was in the Navy, I got my shipping orders to join a landing ship that was going to North Africa. The Tasker H. Bliss. I remember the name.
When you were a chief petty officer.
Yeah, I got shipping orders to go up, I think it was New York, to the ship was a Tasker H. Bliss, an attack transport. That was the name of it. But the week before, I had fallen down a ladder at the hospital. They put me in the hospital. And I had some wonderful doctors from Harvard Medical School who were in the Navy. And one of them listened to my heart, listened to this, listened to that. She says, no, you have a heart problem. I says, I do? Not till I know. She says, you have a heart problem. I'm going to write that up. So I was in the Naval Hospital for 1 month. Then I had what they called an interview. At that time, the policy in the Navy was, if you weren't fit for sea duty, you weren't fit for the Navy. So I was asked.
This is during the war.
Yeah. I was asked point blank by Dr. Landing, Captain Landing, the chief of the Naval Hospital. Do you want to stay? We have no job for you. I said, okay, let me go. And I had an honorable discharge, a medical discharge, because I never got compensation. I didn't even ask for it. I got out. They wanted to send me out, but I wasn't fit for sea duty, because that was the policy. Not now. Now you get a desk job.
Mm-hmm.
But then, that was the point. You had to be fit. So that's a little sign. Anyhow, I came out, had my first office. My first office when I got out, not out of the Navy, when I started to practice, general practice, was 1009 Madison Street, next door to Sidney Chagrin, the dentist, and had a combination office with the late Joseph Kyle, also a dentist.
You shared the office with Kyle?
With Joseph Kyle.
Uh-huh.
I had five rooms for the magnificent rent of $25 a month.
And this was in 1940?
This was 1939, 40, up to 41.
41,
yeah,
okay.
The date. I may get my dates a little mixed. Blame it on the fact that I may have lost neurons to remember. Anyhow, when I came back, I opened up an office at 6th and Broome. And when I got out of the Navy, I opened up an office at 1009 Madison Street, which is a magic number for me. I still own the building. And
how long did you practice there?
15, 16 years. Uh-huh. And I moved to 502 Rockwood Road. By that time, I was already doing anesthesia.
So when you moved to Rockwood Road and Brandywine Hills, you were no longer doing private practice?
Just a little bit.
By that time there was a Riverside
Hospital, Clifton Park.
Yeah.
And incidentally, I learned my anesthesia at a place where nobody knew I was a DO, a Class A medical teaching place, Albert Einstein Northern Division. When I started there in 1949, my cousin Lou Shinfield said, look, we need somebody. You can drop ether, can't you? I said, yeah, I did. He says, we need somebody to give counsel anesthesia. They had no organized department as such, only nurses. And some of the nurses had quit. I went there. I was there for 5 years, from 1949 to 45, when we opened up the first osteopathic. 49 to 54, when we opened up Riverside Hospital in Clifton Park. Lou knew I was a DO. His partner, whose name I'm forgetting, I knew I was a DO. And the administrator knew I was a DO in those days.
But no one else?
No one else. Mr. Lucchese, who became the first chief director of that hospital, after the name was changed from the Jewish Hospital of Philadelphia to Einstein Northern Division, because Sinai Hospital was at 5th and Reed, and that was the Southern Division, which is no more. It was sold. But yeah. In those days, we had two divisions.
So what did you do? Train?
I learned anesthesia.
You trained in anesthesia?
I trained anesthesia. They took me carte blanche, a face
And value. In those days, did they
there
get
was
tests?
There was no such things as looking up credentials.
Uh-huh. But did they, for instance, did you have to take exams afterwards?
No.
So
afterwards, I became certified. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And when you became certified, Einstein?
By osteopathic board.
By the osteopathic
board. And since our little hospital didn't have that many cases, in those days, the examiners would go to whatever hospital you were in to watch you, one, give anesthesia and see what you knew. So I had to pay the expenses of two of my examiners at the Bellevue Stratford, and they come up to Jewish and watch me give anesthesia.
Before they certified.
Oh, then I took an examination. I took an examination in 1953 and was certified before the hospital opened up.
Uh-huh.
I was looking ahead. Maybe I was one of these lucky guys.
Yeah, but so you became board certified before it was the common practice to do that.
Yeah,
so
no, well,
did anyone do it?
MDs became certified. That
did they?
Sure. I belong to the American Society of Anesthesiologists, not as a certified member, but just to join the society and get their journals. But that's an unusual. It's unbelievable. Nobody asked me where you went to school, where you interned, nothing. No credit. Today you couldn't do it. 10 years ago you couldn't do it. I gave up my work and I lectured. I gave anesthesia to two of my chief's parents. They picked me out because I was interested in geriatric anesthesia then. I even gave a paper in Jerusalem on anesthesia for the patient over the age of 70 at a Gerontological Congress. Anyhow, the only way one of my chiefs knew I was a DO was I went to a meeting in New Jersey and I had my thing. I never was ashamed of who I was. Abraham A. Golden, DO, only to Delaware. She looked. I said, Lillian, I'm the same doctor who gave your mother and father their anesthesia.
Yeah.
She did not know. None of the DOs who sent kids over there, all of the DOs, a lot of them knew where I was. Nobody said a thing that you have a DO on your staff. I saved the literature and my letters of recommendation from the outstanding surgeons then in Philadelphia. We were affiliated with Temple. And I had the chief of neurosurgery give me a recommendation, so many things. So when I took my exams, it was proof that I was in a medical hospital. All I wanted was knowledge. I wanted to learn my stuff.
So, tell me something about the beginning of Riverside and your role in it.
Well, Riverside Hospital. First, there was a little hospital run by a Dr. Merritt Davis at 10th and Madison. He converted his home into a little hospital. We had 10 rooms. We used to carry patients from the third floor to the second floor with an operating room that you spread your hands and you touch the walls, and on a flexible litter, you know, like a canvas litter. And after 4 years there, 3 years, a Mr. Danby gave money to start the hospital. Dr. Bradford Sr., nose and throat man, helped out. Anyhow, the place started at the old Sellers Institute, a Mason that was converted. The old library became a delivery room. The ballroom became a four-bedded room. And then we had one or two private rooms. And that's where we stayed and we grew.
You were there from the beginning?
From the very beginning.
And your role was?
I started the anesthesia department.
Uh-huh.
And it became known all over. The MDs in the other hospital respected me for what I was doing. As a matter of fact, when I went to Israel 4 different times, I had to leave the hospital. The guys from St. Francis and the Delaware Hospital, at that time there was no medical center, they stood in for me. I went to eat, they knew me and I knew them. You'd go at night to examine the patients for surgery the next day. That's the relationship I had with them. Mm. I still have it.
Mm.
See? And
So during these many years, you moved to Lee Boulevard then?
I moved to Lee Boulevard. My wife didn't like the idea. It was a 1.5-story house on Lockwood Road.
I'm not talking about your house, the hospital.
We were talking about
Riverside.
We stayed there from 1954 when it was started until 1972. 1972, the structure that you see today became existent, all right? And our extended care facility, which was dedicated on the 12th of October of 1991, is our building. I happen to be called upon to be the medical director of this place.
Yes. So you have been with the hospital from the very beginning, first as the head of anesthesiology, and now as head of the extended care. And your practice has shifted over to the geriatric.
That's right, which means general practice also, because the older people need a general practitioner. I don't call myself a family practitioner because that means taking care of the whole family.
Yeah.
This I do not do. I don't belong to any of the HMOs in town because they want family physicians. And when somebody has called me a patient, I say, I'll be glad to take care of you. Do you have any children? Yeah, we have three children. I said, I'm sorry. I can't take care of you. Because I don't want the responsibility. Well, I've done enough work. I mean, how much can one do?
Tell me about your involvement with the State of Israel. And where does it, what's interested you in this in the very beginning? And
I was always interested in Israel. From a little child.
In Palestine.
Yeah, but from a little child. We had a little box on the kitchen window. And we put pennies and nickels in. You know, the little box, what do you call that box?
The pishke.
The pishke, that's right, the pishke. My mother, we have the original charter of the Hadassah organization in Delaware.
And your mother?
My mother was, Lashulam was a charter member, along with Mrs. Brodsky. There were two Brodskys. All of the old line Jewish families in Wilmington who were associated with the Bikur Cholim on West Street.
Yes, all Jewish families were involved with Bikur Cholim.
Sure.
But they weren't all involved with Hadassah.
No, but I'm telling you the names. If I were to recall, read you on the back of this certificate, when they got their franchise, so to speak.
Is it possible for us to have that in the Jewish Historical Society?
You'll have to ask my wife.
She's
had it exhibited at her Hadassah meeting.
Has she?
Yes,
that would be wonderful if we could.
You'll have to ask her. I love it.